So, I'm Rob. I'm a senior in Kirkland. This is my third year TFing CS50. It is the first time that we are changing from the traditional lecture style section where we just kind of review what happened in lecture and then you guys ask questions. Now it's going to be a lot more problem-based where we use spaces and so the idea is go to that link I sent you and then you'll be in my space. Does anyone not have a laptop? Looks like. All right. So we're going to be using this, and we're going to be doing problems live in section and discussing them and figuring out what's wrong. And I might pull up some of your code, and I might discuss your ideas. So has anyone had difficulty? You can chat on the side. I don't know if we'll have reason for that. Now, like the previous super section, if you were at that slash know what that's about, on all of your p-sets, there's going to be these sections. So p-set 2, specification, I guess you saw it on p-set 1 already. But we can look at p-sets 2 for what we're going to be going over today. And you'll see a section of questions. So this will be in all of the p-sets, there will be a section of questions. Yeah, so far we've said consider this an opportunity to practice. You won't be asked to submit this program. The idea is that these are supposed to kind of help you get started with the problem set. I guess on the Hacker Edition, a lot of them are supposed to just be new, interesting things to learn. They may not be directly applicable to the problem set. And right now we're not having you submit them, but in theory for later problem sets, you might submit them, and thus you can either come to section or watch the section to get the answers, or you can just do them on your own if you don't feel like enjoying my presence. So I think this is the first one. Oh, also for under the section of questions, we also have you ask questions about the shorts. So I guess in theory, you're supposed to watch these before coming to section, but it's fine if you don't, and we'll go over them anyway. So we can start with these. How does a while loop differ from a do while loop? When is the latter particularly useful? So, anyone have any?
The do while loop will always execute at least once.
Yes, so that is the difference. A while loop, I'm gonna do it on here. While loop, we have the condition right here. Whereas do while, we don't have the condition until we get down here. And so when your program's executing and it gets to the while loop, it immediately checks if this condition is true. If that condition is not true, it will just skip over the loop entirely. Do while loop, as your program is executing, it gets to the do, nothing happens at this point, just continues executing. Then when it hits the while, if the condition is true, it'll loop back and do it again and again and again until the condition is not true, and then it just falls through. So the difference being that this can skip right from the very start. This necessarily executes once and then may execute more times if the condition is still true. So the while loop will only do it once, or the while loop, we may not need to do it at all, since as soon as we get to it, if the condition is false, we'll just skip right over it. Whereas the do while loop, we will execute it once necessarily. Then when we get to the condition, we check if it's true or false. If it's true, we'll do it again. If it's false, we'll just continue going. So when is the latter particularly useful? So I can say that in the entirety of the 4 years, 3 years, whatever, that I've been programming, I have used this like under 10 times. So, and probably like 5 of them are in CS50 when we're introducing do while loops. So when do you use do while loops? When is the, yeah.
When you're trying to get user input or something, you want to check if it's
there. Yeah, so do while loops, user input is the big one. So that's why on the first couple problem sets, when you want to ask the user, like, give me a string, You can't continue until you get that string. And so you necessarily need to ask for the string at least once. But then if they enter something bad, then you need to loop back and ask again. But other than user input, it's very rare that I encounter a case where I want to loop at least once, but possibly more. Questions? Or has anyone used a do-while loop anywhere else? Okay, so the next one is, what does undeclared identifier usually indicate if outputted by Clang? So what kind of code could I write to get undeclared identifier?
X equals 2.
Yeah, so we can just try it in here. So x equals 2. I'll run this. Oh, I didn't click it. So here we get, all right, try. Use of undeclared identifier x. So that's the undeclared identifier. A variable, it'll frequently call a variable an identifier. So it might not know it's actually a variable. It just doesn't know what it is. So it's an identifier. So why is it undeclared? Yeah. So to be clear on like terminology, the declaration of a variable is when you say int x or or string y, whatever. The initialization of the variable or the assignment of the variable is whenever you say x equals 2. So we can do these in separate steps, int x, x equals 2. And until, we could have a bunch of stuff in here, but until this line happens, x is still uninitialized, but it has been declared. And so we can obviously do it in one line, and now we are declaring and initializing. Questions. And finally, why is the Caesar cipher not very secure? So first, does anyone want to say what the Caesar cipher is?
Caesar cipher just is that you map, you shift every letter a certain number of letters over and loop back over. And it's not very secure because there's only 26 possible options. And you just have to try each one of those until you get that.
Yeah.
Instead of
jerking it. Oh, so I should repeat. The Caesar cipher, you'll be dealing with it on the problem set. The standard edition of the problem set, that's not on the hacker edition. So on the standard edition of the problem set, it's you get a message like hello world, and you also have a number like 6, and so you take that message and each individual character, you rotate it by 6 positions in the alphabet. So the H in hello would become H I J K L M N. So the first letter would be N. And we do the same thing with E. If we have a like Z or something, then we wrap back around to A. But each character gets cycled 6 characters later in the alphabet. And it's not very secure since there are only 26 possibilities for how many ways you could wrap a single letter. So you can just try all 26 of them. And presumably, for a long enough message, only one of those possible 26 things is going to be legible. And the legible one is going to be the original message. So it's not a very good way of encrypting anything at all. Unrelated to those shorts, what is a function? So what is a function? Yes. Yeah.
Go through and then just get the return value or whatever.
Yeah. So I guess I'll answer it by also answering next, or repeat by also just answering the next one. You can use functions instead of just copying and pasting code over and over again. Just take that code, put it into a function, and then you can just call the function wherever you had been copying and pasting. So functions are useful. So now we'll do actual problems. The first one, so the idea of the first one is we pass it a string, and regardless of the, or does it say all lowercase? It does not say all lowercase. So the message can be anything, and, oh no, it does. For simplicity, you may assume that the user will only input lowercase letters and spaces. So we pass it a message with only lowercase letters, and then we alternate between capital and lowercase. We change the string to be capital and lowercase alternating. So before we give you a second to even dive into the problem, what is the first thing we need to do? Oh, just click on it. Oh, I clicked on an email in here. So the first thing we need to do, am I looking at the wrong one? Is this part of this one? Oh, those are still in there though. Okay, still here. So now we cannot assume, yes, here we cannot assume that it's only lowercase and spaces. So now we have to deal with the fact that the letters can be whatever we want them to be. And so the first thing we want to do is just get the message. We just need to get a string. So string s equals get string. Okay, so now this problem, there are a couple of ways of doing it, but we are going to want to use bitwise operators here. So are there people who either were not at the super section or something and don't know what bitwise operators are, or how they relate to ASCII in any way?
I wasn't at the super section,
okay,
but I know what bitwise operators are.
Okay, so then I don't have to go over the basics of them, but I'll explain what we're going to want to use here. So A, binary representation of capital A. The number is 65. I'm just going to look at 41 is going to be 0100001. So that should be 65 in decimal. So this is the binary representation of the character capital A. Now the binary representation of the character lowercase a is going to be the same thing, almost. Is that six? Yeah, this is right. So binary capital A, binary lowercase a. So notice that the difference between capital A and lowercase a is this single bit. And this happens to be the 32 bit, the bit representing the number 32. And that makes sense since capital A is 65, lowercase a is 97, the difference between them is 32. So now we know we can convert from a capital A to a lowercase a by taking capital A and bitwise ORing it with, that looks like a 1, this is a bitwise OR, with 00100000. And that'll give us lowercase a. And we can get from lowercase a to capital A by bitwise ANDing with 110 in that place, 11111. So this will then give us exactly what lowercase a was, but cancel out this individual bit. So we'll have 01000001. I don't know if I counted right. But this technique of bitwise ORing to get from capital to lowercase and bitwise ANDing to get from lowercase to capital isn't exclusive to A. All of the letters, capital K versus lowercase k, capital Z versus lowercase z, all of them are just going to differ by this single bit. And so you can use this to change from any lowercase letter to any capital letter and vice versa. Okay, so an easy way of getting from this, so instead of having to write out whatever 11011111 is, an easy way of representing this number, and this isn't one that I went over in the super section, but tilde is another bitwise operator. And so what tilde does is it looks at the bit representation. Let's take any number. It's just some binary number. And what tilde does is it just flips all of the bits. So this was a 1, it's now a 0. This is a 0, it's now a 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0. So that's all tilde does. So 32 is going to be the number. Get rid of that. So 32 is going to be the number 00100000. And so tilde of this is going to be this number up here that I anded lowercase a with. So everyone see that? This is pretty common, like when you want to figure out for later things that we might be seeing, when we want to see if like, or we want everything, every single bit set except for one, you tend to do tilde of the bit that we don't want set. So we don't want the 32 bit set, so we do tilde of 32. Okay, so we can use all of those here. Okay. All right, so it's fine if you're not done. We shall slowly walk over together, or walk over this. So through this, walk through this. So we have our string, and we want to loop over each character in that string and do something to it. So how do we loop over a string? What should we use? If I can do it on here. Yeah. So I have my iterator, and he said it, but how do I know how many characters are in the string? Strlen of s, and then I plus plus. So what I've done here isn't the best way of doing things. Does anyone know why?
Because you're checking the length of the string every single time.
Exactly. So we are going to want to move strlen, I could say up here, int length equals strlen of s, and then do I is less than length. And in case you haven't seen it before, I could also do int I equals 0, comma, length equals strlen of s. And so this is somewhat preferable, since now I've restricted the scope of the variable length to just this for loop, instead of declaring it before and that it always exists. And in case you didn't catch why that's bad, or why the original was bad, it's I start the for loop. I check the condition. Is I less than the length of s? So the length of s, let's work with hello the entire time. So the length of s, H-E-L-L-O, length is 5. So I equals 0, length is 5. So I is not less than 5, so the loop continues. Then we go again, we check the condition. Is I less than the length of hello? So let's check the length of hello. H-E-L-L-O, that's 5. I is not less than 5, so we continue again. So we are calculating, we are counting H-E-L-L-O for each iteration of the loop, even though it's never going to change, it's always going to be 5. So we just remember 5 up front, and now everything's better. So iterating over the entire string. What do we want to do for each character of the string?
We want condition checking if it's an output, if it's between like 64 and 91.
Yeah. So if the character is not non-alphabetic, then we just want to skip over it because we only care about alphabetic letters. We can't capitalize a number. So how can we do this? So our condition. So if we want something, check if it's alphabetic. Alphabetical? Alphabetic?
Cool.
So how do we check this?
You can just use the function isAlpha.
Is that included in either of these, or any include like char.h or something? Let's not use the isAlpha function and use the explicit. So we have si, that is the ith character of s. Remember that a string is an array of characters. So the ith character of s. Now, if it is a capital letter, we know it has to be in a specific range. And what is that range? Yeah, so if sy is greater than or equal to 65, And S of I is less than or equal to 90. So what should I do instead? Yeah, so you should absolutely never even need to know the ASCII values of anything ever. Never think of the numbers 65, 90, 97, and 102, or whatever it is. You don't need 112. You don't need to know those at all. That's wrong, too. Only use the single quote character, single quote constants. So single quote A. And less than 90 is single quote Z. And this is significantly better. I would not know off the top of my head that capital Z is 90. I do know off the top of my head that single quote capital Z single quote is capital Z. So as long as this is in the range of capital A to capital Z, or we can check for lowercase. So, or if it's in the range greater than or equal to lowercase a and less than or equal to lowercase z. So that's our condition. The style for where to put these things varies. I'll do it like this. So now what do we want to do? We know this letter is a character, an alphabetical character. So we need to alternate between whether this should now be a capital letter or a lowercase letter. How do we keep track of which one we want it to be? So yes, but let me check. Modulo 2 was said. Was a suggestion thrown out, and I agree with that. Except, notice that, like, is this the case? Yeah, so it's every other one, but we can't just do modulo 2 of I, or I mod 2, since notice that E is capital and A is lowercase, but there's a space separating them. So they're going to be the same mod 2, but they're different cases. Yeah. So we're just going to keep a count. We could also do that in here if we wanted. That might get a little unwieldy in the for loop declaration. So I'll put it up here. So int count equals starts at 0. And so now I'm going to count how many alphabetical characters we've had. So we're inevitably going to be doing count plus plus since we found another alphabetical character. But, so now you're saying if count mod 2. So what if count mod 2? Oh, I'll do equals 0 for now. We'll also go over that. So if count mod 2 equals 0, then what?
Then you're going to take it from lowercase to uppercase.
Yeah.
We're gonna check this lowercase.
So we want it to end up uppercase. There are two cases. Uppercase and lowercase are the two cases. So if we're in lowercase, we need to make it uppercase. If it is uppercase, we don't need to do anything. But is there a way, shouldn't have flipped, well, that we don't even need to check whether it's uppercase or lowercase? What can we do to always make sure we end up at uppercase? So notice what we did for lowercase a. What if we did this same exact thing to uppercase a? Does uppercase a change? Or does the value change? Yeah, so any capital letter bitwise anded with tilde 32 is going to be that same uppercase character. Because for any uppercase character, the 32nd bit is not set. So if we want to bring the character si, we want it to become lowercase or uppercase. So if it was lowercase, it is now uppercase. If it was uppercase, it's still uppercase. And that's it. I said this in the super section. You can use 32 if you want, but I tend to prefer doing lowercase a minus capital A instead of just plain 32 because it could be any other bit after the 32-bit, it couldn't be any of these, or we wouldn't have enough numbers to represent all of the characters. So it could be the 32-bit, it could be the 64-bit, it could be the 128-bit. Any of those bits could be the bit that distinguishes between uppercase and lowercase. I shouldn't need to know that it's the 32-bit. So I can use this, lowercase a minus capital A, to get the bit that differs between the two without needing to rely on the magic number that is 32. And so now else count was odd, and so what do I want to do?
Or 32.
Yeah.
Or
what's that?
So I will do it 1 second. So now if I want to make sure the character is now lowercase, and so I can OR by 32, and 32 being lowercase a minus capital A. But notice, by the same reasoning as the previous one, that if the letter was already lowercase, then ORing by 32 just keeps it lowercase. It hasn't changed the original character. But now I don't have to avoid saying, if it is lowercase, just forget about it. If it's uppercase, then change it. It's much more convenient to do this.
So would that strategy of subtracting the uppercase from the lowercase work if it weren't 32, but were like 34 or something?
So you need to know that the difference between the two is
one bit.
It could be more than one bit, as long as all of the bits below this position are the same. So we need at least 26 characters, or there are 26 characters, so we need at least 26 numbers to represent the difference. The difference between capital A and lowercase a has to be at least 26, or else we wouldn't have represented all the capital numbers.
Right.
So that means that capital A is, if we start at 1, it's going to use all of these bits, all of these first 5 bits, to represent everything through capital Z. That's why the next bit, or this bit, the next bit, is the one that is chosen to distinguish between capital A and lowercase a. Mm-hmm. That's also why in the ASCII table, there are 5 symbols separating capital letters from lowercase letters, since that then those are the symbols, the extra 5 that brings up to 32 being the difference between them.
So we can do it because ASCII's designed that way.
Yes. But ASCII, the difference could also be both of these bits. Like, if capital A were 1000001, and lowercase a were 111000, I forget, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if it were this, then we could still use lowercase a minus capital A, mm-hmm. since now the difference between capital A and lowercase a is still these two bits. I think it's more than 48. Is it 32 plus 64? I think it is.
Okay.
But it would still be 2 bits. Uh-huh. Every single character, like capital Z and lowercase z, capital K and lowercase k, they would still have the same exact bit set except for those 2 bits. So as long as that's always true, regardless of if we're using ASCII or some other system, as long as there's only a set number of bits that are different for each character, then that works fine. It's just that 32 was set up because it's the first one we could possibly use.
Cool.
So now, I tend to prefer, in case you haven't seen, if the block is only a single line, you can get rid of the curly braces. So I tend to prefer doing this. Also, so you know how we can do things like si plus equals 1? You can also do si bitwise and equals 32. And bitwise OR equals 32. Mm. Also, count mod 2 equals equals 0. So remember that, I won't write it, any non-zero value is true, and 0 is false. So if count mod 2 equals equals 0 is the same as saying if not count mod 2. I probably would have just reversed the lines and said if count mod 2, do the or 1, else do the and 1, so that I didn't need the not. But this works just as well. And what else can I do here? You could combine them with ternary if you wanted, but then that just make things messier and probably more difficult to read, so we won't do that. Anyone have any other suggestions? Is that all the problem asks for? Oh, yeah. So there it is, empty lines. Now we will printf percent %s being the one for character strings. We will printf s. Now let's run it. Did I do anything wrong? That's a backslash quote. I want an n. Okay. Now we'll run it. It'll probably yell at me. String strlen is in string.h. So this is the nice thing about Clang is it tells you what it's in instead of GCC, which just says, hey, you forgot something. I don't know what it was. But this will tell me you meant to include string.h. So I didn't prompt for anything, so it's not saying anything. But we'll do their example. Thanks for the add. And that looks right. Hooray!
Should we return 0?
Okay.
So returning 0 on main, I almost never do it. It's optional. And main is the only function for which it is optional. If you do not return anything for main, it's assumed that you meant to return 0. Questions? Okay. So now the second problem. Recall from week 2's second lecture that swapping two variables' values by passing those two variables to a function, even if called swap, doesn't exactly work, at least not without pointers. And ignore pointers until we get to them. So we want to swap two variables. We're not using a function to do it. We're still going to do it in main, like it says. But to use those two variables, we don't want to use a temporary variable. So there are two ways to do this. You can do it using your traditional binary operators. So does anyone know a quick and dirty way of doing that? It might actually take a minute of thinking. If I have I'll set the problem up like they asked. So if I have two variables A, which is an integer that they give me, and some variable B, which is another integer that I'm given. So if I have these two variables, now I want to swap them. So the traditional using your regular binary operators, I mean like plus, minus, divide, not bitwise operators, which act on binary. So using minus, plus, divide, and all of those, we could swap by doing something like A equals A plus B, then B equals A minus B, A equals B, or A minus B. So sanity check. And then we'll see why that works. So let's say A equals 7, B equals 3. Then A plus B is going to be 10. So we're now setting A equal to 10. And then we're doing B equals A minus B. So we're doing B equals A minus B, which is going to be 7. And B equals A minus B again, or A equals B minus, A equals A minus B, which is going to be 10 minus 7, which is 3. So now, correctly, A was 7, B was 3, and now B is 7, A is 3. So that kind of makes sense. A is the combination of the two numbers. At this point, A is the combination. And then we're subtracting out the original B, and then we're subtracting out what was the original A. But this does not work on all computer for all numbers. So to see this, let's consider a system. So we usually think of integers as 32 bits. Let's work on something that's only like 4 bits. So hopefully I come up with a good example right now. So I know this will be easy. So let's say our two numbers are 1111 and 1111. So we're in binary right now.
Thank you.
So in actual decimal, if you wanted to think of it that way, A is 15 and B is 15. And so we expect after we swap them, they don't even have to be the same numbers, but I did it this way. So let's make them not the same numbers. Let's just do 1111 and 0001. So A is 15 and B is 1. So after we swap them, we expect A to be 1 and B to be 15. So our first step is A equals A plus B. Our numbers are only 4 bits wide. So A, which is 1111, plus B, which is 0001, is going to end up being 10000, but we only have 4 bits. So now A is 0. So A equals 0. And now we want to set B equal to A minus B. Actually, this still works out perfectly. A equals A minus B. Let's see if this worked out perfectly. So then B is equal to 0 minus 1, which should still be 15. And then A equals A minus B, which should be 1. Maybe this does work. I feel like there's a reason it doesn't work using regular. Okay. So working on the assumption that it doesn't work with regular binary operations, and I will Google to see if that is true. We want to do it using bitwise operators. And the clue here is XOR. So introducing XOR, if you have not seen it yet, it's again a bitwise operator, so it acts bit by bit. And it's if you have the bits 0 and 1, then this will be 1. If you have the bits 1 and 0, it'll be 1. If you have the bits 0, 0, it'll be 0. And if you have the bits 1 and 1, it'll be 0. So it's like OR. If either of the bits are true, it's 1. But unlike OR, it can't be both bits that are true. OR would have this be 1, XOR has this be 0. So we're going to want to use XOR here. Think about it for a minute. I'm going to Google. Well, you can't read that. I'm currently on the XOR swap algorithm page. But hopefully this will explain why I can't. This is exactly the algorithm we just did. I still don't see why. I must have just picked a bad example. But this case where A happened to become 0 after getting to 5 bits, so now A is 0, that is what is called integer overflow. And so according to Wikipedia, unlike the XOR swap, this variation requires that it uses some methods to guarantee that X plus Y does not cause an integer overflow. So this does have problems. This was integer overflow, but I did something wrong. Not sure. I'll try to come up with another one.
Well, isn't integer overflow when you're trying to put a number in there bigger than the amount of bits you have allocated?
Yeah. So that's, we have 4 bits. We had 4 bits. We then tried to add 1 to it, so we end up with 5 bits, but the 5th bit just gets cut off. Yeah. It might actually...
Does that throw you an error, or does that... Would that throw an error?
No.
No.
So there's no error. When you get to the assembly level, like a special bit somewhere is set that said there was an overflow, but in C you kind of just don't deal with that. You actually can't deal with it unless you use especially assembly instructions in C. Let's think about XOR swap. And I think the Wikipedia article might have also been saying that, so it also brought up modular arithmetic. So I guess I was, in theory, doing modular arithmetic when I said that 0 minus 1 is 15 again. So that might actually, on a regular processor that does 0 minus 1 equals 15, since we end up at 0, we subtract 1, so then it just wraps back around to 1, 1, 1, 1. So this algorithm might actually work, the A plus B, A minus B, B minus A. That might be fine. But there are some processors which don't do that, and so it would not be fine on those specific ones. XOR swap will work on any processor. Okay, so the idea is that it's supposed to be the same though, where we are using XOR to somehow get the information of both into one of the variables, and then pull out the information of the individual variables again. So, does anyone have ideas slash the answer? So this should work. And also, XOR is commutative. So regardless of which order these two numbers happen to be in up here, this result is going to be the same. And so A XOR B is B XOR A. You might also see this written as like A XOR equals B, B XOR equals A, A XOR equals B again. So this is right. And to see why this works, think of the bits. And using a smallish number, let's say 11001 and 01100. So this is A, this is B. So A XOR equals B. We're going to be setting A equal to the XOR of these two things. So 1 XOR 0 is
1.
1 XOR 1.
0.
0 XOR 1. And 0, 0, 1, 0. So A, if you look at the decimal number, it's going to be, you're not going to see much of a relationship between the original A and the new A. But looking at the bits, A is now like a mesh of the information of both the original A and the original B. And so if we take B XOR A, we see that we'll end up at the original A. And if we take A XOR, or the original A XOR the new A, we see we end up at the original B. And so this, so A XOR B, XOR B, B equals the original A, and A XOR B XOR A equals the original B. And so there is another way of seeing this is anything XOR itself is always zero. So 1101 XOR 1101, all of the bits are going to be the same, so there's never going to be a case where one is a zero and the other is one, and so this is 0000. And so the same with this, A XOR B XOR B is like A XOR B XOR B, B XOR B is going to be zero, A XOR zero is just going to be A since all the bits are zero, so the only ones are going to be where A was originally a one, had ones. And the same idea here, I'm pretty sure it's also commutative, so yeah, I did say that before, it was commutative. So B XOR A, and it's associative. So now B XOR A, XOR A, and we can do B XOR A, XOR A. And so again, we get the original B. So A is now the combination of A and B together. And so using our new combo A, we say B equal to combo A, XOR the original B, we get the original A. And now A equal combo A, XOR the new B, which was the original, or which is now what was A. B. So that's this case down here. This is equal to B, old B. So now everything is back in the swapped order. If we actually looked at the bits, B equals A XOR B is going to XOR these two, and the answer is going to be this. And then A equals A XOR B is XORing these two, and the answer is this. Questions? OK, so the last one is somewhat significantly more difficult.
I think there's a question.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, sorry.
What's actually like faster if you use like this XOR, or is if you like declare new variables as well?
So what is actually faster, declaring a new variable or using XOR to swap? The answer is, in all likelihood, temporary variable. And that is because once it's compiled down, so at the like assembly level, there is no such thing as local variables or any temporary variables or any of this stuff. They're just like, there's memory and there are registers, where registers are like where things are actively happening. You like, you don't add two things in memory, you add two things in registers. And you bring things from memory into registers to then add them, and then you might put them back into memory. But everything, all the action happens in registers. So when you're using the temporary variable approach, usually what happens is these two numbers are already in registers. And then from that point on, once after you swapped them, it'll just start using the other register. So anywhere you had been using B, it'll just use the register that was already storing A. So it doesn't need to do anything to actually do the swap. Yeah.
But it'll still take more memory, right?
So it will only take more memory if it needs to store that temporary variable. Like if you later use that temporary variable again somewhere, then, or like you assign something to that temporary variable. So if at any point in time A, B, and temp have like distinct values or something, then it's going to have distinct locations in memory. But it is true that there are many local variables which will only exist in registers, in which case it's never put into memory, and so you're never wasting memory. Okay. Last question. Is a bit more. So here, in the CS50 appliance, there is a dictionary. And the reason for this is because PSET6 is a spell checker where you will be writing a using hash tables or tries or some data structure. You're going to be writing a spell checker, and you're going to be using this dictionary to do that. But for this problem, we are just going to look up to see if a single word is in the dictionary. So instead of storing the entire dictionary in some data structure and then looking over an entire document to see if anything's misspelled, we just want to find one word. So we can just scan over the entire dictionary. And if we never find the word in the entire dictionary, then it wasn't in there. If we scan over the entire dictionary and do see the word, then we're good. We found it. So it says here that we want to start using looking at C's file handling function, since we want to read the dictionary. But I will give the hint here as to which functions you should think of. I'll write them on spaces. So the main ones you'll want to look at are fopen. And then inevitably fclose, which will go at the end of your program, and fscanf. So you could also use like fread, but you probably don't want to, because that you don't end up needing that. Fscanf is what you're going to be using to scan over the dictionary. And so you don't need to code up the solution, just try and like pseudocode your way to a solution, and then we'll discuss it. And actually, since I already gave you these, if you go into any terminal or your appliance's shell, I usually, if you have not seen yet, I don't know if you did in class, but man, so the man pages are pretty useful for looking at pretty much any function. So I can do like man fscanf. And this is now the info about the scanf family of functions. I could also do man fopen, and that'll give me the details of that. So if you know what function you are using, or like you're reading code and you see some function, you're like, what does this do? Just man that function name. There are a couple of weird examples where I might have to say like man to that function name, or man three that function name, but you only have to do that if man function name doesn't happen to work the first time.
So I'm reading the man page for fopen, but I'm still confused on how to use it.
A lot of the man pages are less than helpful. They're more helpful if you like already know what they do, and then you just need to like remember the order of the arguments or something. Or they can give you a general overview, but some of them are very overwhelming. Like fscanf also, it gives you the information for like all of these functions, and like one line down here happens to say fscanf reads from the stream pointer stream. But fopen. So how would we use fopen? The idea of a program which needs to do file I/O is that you first need to open the file you want to do things with, and inevitably read things from that file and do stuff with them. So fopen is what we use to open the file. The thing we get back, so what file do we want to open? It gives us the in here it says slash user slash share slash dict slash words. So this is the file that we want to open. And we want to open it, we have to explicitly specify whether we want to open it to read or if we want to open it to write. There's a couple of combinations and stuff, but we want to open this for reading. We want to read from the file. So what does this return? Or returns a file star, and I'll just store it in the variable f. So star, again, it's a pointer, but we don't want to deal with pointers. You can think of f is now the variable you are going to use to represent the file. So if you want to read from the file, you read from f. If you want to close the file, you close f. So at the end of the program, when we inevitably want to close the file, what should we do? We want to close f. So now the last file function that we're going to want to use is scanf, fscanf. And what that does is it scans over the file looking for a pattern to match. And so looking at, keep this to the side, looking at the man page here, we see int fscanf, ignore int the return value for now. The first argument is the file star stream. So the first argument we're going to want to pass is f. We're scanning over f. The second argument is a format string. And so I will give you a format string right now. I think we happen to say 127s/n. A lot of that's unnecessary. The idea of what this format string is you can think of scanf as like the opposite of printf. So printf, we also use this type of format parameter. But in printf, what we're doing is, well, let's look at an equivalent. So printf. And there's actually also fprintf, where the first argument is going to be f. So when you printf, we could say something like print 127s/n. And then if we pass it some string, it's going to print this string and then a new line. What 127 means, I'm pretty sure, but I've never restricted myself to it. You wouldn't even need to say 127 in printf. But what it means is print the first 127 characters. So I'm pretty sure that's the case. You can Google for that. But in the next one, I'm almost positive it means that. So This is print the first 127 characters followed by a new line. Fscanf, now, instead of looking at a variable and printing it, it's going to look at some string and store the pattern into the variable. So let's actually use scanf in a different example. So let's say we had some int x equals 4, and we wanted to create a string made of, we wanted to create the string that was like, this will come up much later, something that's just like 4.jpg. So this might be a program where you have some counter I, and you want to save a bunch of images. So you want to save like i.jpg, where I is some iteration of your loop. So how do we make this string 4.jpg? If you wanted to print 4.jpg, we could just say printf %d.jpg, and then it would print 4.jpg. But if we want to save the string 4.jpg, we use scanf. So string s, actually we can't, character char s, let's go 100. So I've just declared some array of 100 characters. And that's what we're inevitably going to be storing 4.jpg in. So we're going to use scanf. And the format, like how we would say %d.jpg in order to print 4.jpg, the format of this is going to be %d.jpg. So the format is %d.jpg. What we want to replace %d with is x. And now we need to store that string somewhere. And where we're going to store the string is in the array s. So after this line of code, s, if we printf %s of the variable s, it's going to print 4.jpg. So fscanf is the same as scanf, except now it's looking over this file for what to store in s. That's what the last argument is going to be. We want to store scanf family of functions scans input according to format as described below. If any are stored in the location pointed to by pointer arguments. No, we might be good. Let me think for a second. So scanf does not, what the heck is the function which does that? So scanf isn't going to take an integer and do .jpg. It's going to save int variable in string and c. What is this variable, or what is this function called?
It's for now.
Yes! That's yes. So what I was defining to you before was sprintf, which that makes much more sense why I said it was much more like printf. Scanf is still kind of like printf, but sprintf is going to scan over and like replace the variables and now store it in a string. Instead of printing it, it stores it in a string. So ignore that entirely. You can still think of the format specifier as like that of printf. So now, if we wanted to do the 4.jpg thing, we would do sprintf x of this. So what scanf is doing, what was your question going to be?
I'm just confused on what we're trying to do right here with the .jpg. Can you explain that one more time?
So this was, it is less relevant to fscanf now. Hopefully it will tie back in some kind of way.
Okay.
But what I initially was intending to show was this is actually directly relevant to PSET 5, you're going to be using sprintf, okay. Where say we have 100 images, and you want to read image 1.jpg, 2.jpg, 3.jpg.
Okay.
So in order to do that, you need to fopen, and then you have to pass in the string that you want to open. So we would want to open 1.jpg. So in order to create the string that is 1.jpg, we do sprintf of %d.jpg. We can even do for int I equals 0, I is less than 40, I plus plus. So sprintf %d.jpg of I. So after this line, now the variable or the array s is going to be 1.jpg, or 0.jpg, 1.jpg, 2.jpg. And so we can open in turn each image for reading. So that is what sprintf does. Do you see what sprintf is now doing?
Okay, so it's taking, it creates a string something.jpg and stores it.
Yes. Yeah. It
okay.
creates, this is another format string just like scanf and printfs, where it inserts all of the variables into the second argument might be s as opposed to I.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's the case. But whatever the order argument is, it's going to insert all the variables into the format string and then store into our buffer, we call that a buffer, it's where we're storing the string.
Mm-hmm.
So we are storing inside of S the correctly formatted string, percent D having been replaced with 4.
So if we did this, is the variable F just going to be reassigned to
yes.
a different
So we should close
okay.
the original F before doing this.
Okay.
But and then also, if there were not an F open up here, then we would need to say, like, yeah. But it would open 100 different files.
Okay. But we wouldn't be able to access. Or okay.
Okay. So scanf, fscanf, is kind of the same idea, but instead of storing it into a string, it's more like you are now going over a string and pattern matching against that string and storing the results into variables. So you can use scanf to parse over something like 4.jpg
mm-hmm.
and store the integer 4 into some int x. That's what you can use scanf for. Scanf is going to do that at the command line. I'm actually pretty sure this is what the CS50 library does. So when you say get int, it's scanfing over. Scanf is the way you get user input. Fscanf is going to do the same thing, but using a file to scan over. So here, we are scanning over this file. The pattern we are trying to match is some string that is 127 characters long, followed by a new line. So I'm pretty sure we could even just say like match S, since in the dictionary we happen to have, we're guaranteed no word is that long. And also fscanf, I think, will stop at the new line no matter what. But we'll include the new line in the match. And
if we didn't include the new line, wouldn't it like find parts of a word?
Looking at the dictionary. Ugh. So in the dictionary, these are all of our words.
Mm-hmm.
Each one is on a new line.
Okay.
So the scanf is going to pick up this word. If we don't include the new line, then it's possible that the next scanf will just read the new line. But including new line, then we'll just ignore the new line. But we'll never get part of a word since we are always reading up to a new line no matter what.
Well, what if you search for the word CISSA, like C-I-S-S-A?
Yes.
Will it find that and say it's a match?
So
here, correctly spelled word?
here we, it will read in, this is actually a good point. We're never using the current, the word we're looking for is the first command line argument. So string word equals argv1. So the string we're looking for is argv1. We are not looking for word at all in our scanf. What we are doing with scanf is getting each word in the dictionary. And then once we have that word, we're going to use surcomp to compare them. We're going to compare our word and what we just read in. So inevitably, we're going to end up doing a bunch of scanfs until it just so happens that scanf will return it will return one as long as it has matched a new word, and it will return something else as soon as it has failed to match the word. So we are reading over the entire dictionary, storing line by line each word into the variable s. Then we are comparing word with s, and if the comparison equals zero, stir comp happens to run zero if a match was made. So if it was zero, then we can printf matched, or word is in dictionary, or whatever you want to printf. And then we don't want to fclose over and over again. But this is the kind of thing we want to do. And we are not just looking for word in the dictionary. So we could do that. If we wanted to look for their pattern CISSA, like you said before, if we wanted to look for that pattern, then it would fail in the case because that's not actually a word, but one of the words in the dictionary happens to have that in it. So it would match this word, but this subset of the word is not a word itself. But that's not how we're using it. We're reading in each word and then comparing the word we have with that word. So we're always comparing full words. I can send out the finalized solutions later. This is kind of nearly the right answer, I think.
Yeah, declare s.
Oh, did I get rid of that before? Char s, I guess we said 127. I forget what the largest is. We'll just do 128. So now s is long enough. We don't need to print anything. We're also going to want to have to close our file. And that should be about the right answer.